Okay, welcome everybody. Check the sound, looks okay. Thanks for joining me. I always appreciate it, and I appreciate the comments and the questions. Today is September 17th, 2025, and this is another Wednesday webinar. And today we're going to read, we meaning me, chapter 4 of my new biology booklet, and then I'll go over to YouTube and see if there's some live questions. And if you do want to ask a question or have something you think is relevant to say, put it in the put the heading called question so I can eat more easily find it. And I think that's it. The only thing I wanted to say before we get started with that was there was a very interesting summary in the hearings that involved Aaron Seary. I don't think that's for me, sorry. Aaron Seary and a few other people on the I guess Senator Johnson or somebody's hearings. And I just wanted to show that and make a comment or two about this. So let's minimize this. And so this is what I wanted to show. Don't think that's me. So Aaron Seary, I'm sure many of you know, is a lawyer who does a lot with the looking at the safety of vaccines. So this was a hearing. Aaron Seary, the lawyer who's a lawyer for CHD, I think, and he does a lot of work investigating the safety of vaccines, and he's very good. And I mentioned him last time, hoping that he will eventually get on the no virus, no measles bandwagon, because otherwise he will get his hat handed to him, I am afraid. But this was a something that people could download, maybe the summary and use when any if you're ever in a conversation with somebody about vaccines. So I'll just read it. He was did a forensic analysis of this guy, Dr. Scott's 661 placebo-controlled vaccine trials reveals the depth of the deception of these 661 studies that supposedly prove vaccine safety. 576 were for HIV vaccines or other vaccines not on the childhood schedule, therefore completely irrelevant. Of the remaining 94 studies, 70 didn't involve healthy children. For example, trials of HIV positive adults. Of the remaining 24, 21 didn't involve a US licensed vaccine or weren't used as controls to license currently used vaccines. So this means there's three studies. Those three. The first was a chickenpox vaccine trial where the placebo contained neomycin, that's an antibiotic, very toxic. And other ingredients, so not inert. The second was the Gardasil 4 trial, where thousands of girls in the control group got aluminum adjuvant injections with only a few hundred labeled as inert controls, who actually received everything in the vial except the antigens, including polysorbate, sodium borate, and yeast protein, again, not inert. The third was Gardasil 9, which finally had a few hundred receive saline, but only after they received three doses of Gardasil 4. The result, zero trials. Not a single routine vaccine was licensed based on a true placebo-controlled trial. So that is a very damning look at the claim that the vaccines have been tested for safety. I happen to know, I'm not sure which of these Gardasil trials, whether it was nine or four, but one of them just demonstrates the deception that is used in these vaccine trials. So it was thousands of girls, and they gave them the Gardasil series of injections, and they ended up getting a 2.4%, I think that's the number. Don't quote me on that number exactly, but a 2.4% or so incidence of diagnosed autoimmune disease, a new diagnosis in the time period following the vaccines. In other words, these were girls who didn't have an autoimmune disease diagnosis, even though there's obviously no such thing as autoimmune disease. But let's just say that's what they were calling it. And then 2.4% ended up, and I'm not sure the time frame, I think it was in the next 6 to 12 months, ended up with that a autoimmune diagnosis. So that's a pretty high number. But then they did a placebo control, and amazingly, they found the exact same number. Again, I think it was 2.4% in the next 6 to 12 months, got diagnosed with an autoimmune disease in the neck as a result in the time following those injections. So obviously, the conclusion was, well, you see, that's just the baseline rate of how many girls just, naturally come down with an autoimmune disease like every 6 months. That's 2.4%. That control was this that he's talking about was everything in the test dose. In other words, the actual, vaccine dose, except for the alleged HPV virus, which of course is not a virus. It's the basically the broken down cell culture or proteins taken from that cell culture. I'm not sure which one they used. So everything else is considered inert. So all the aluminum and the polysorbate and the sodium borate and the yeast protein, and the, like I said, the aluminum, that was not the virus, allegedly. So that's not what they were testing. So they call that an inert placebo. So what that study actually shows is that this incidence of 2.4%. Two and a half out of 100 girls end up with a diagnosis that may be lifelong as a result of a injection with a substance which can't possibly do them any good. They, as a result of that, 2.5% or so end up with an autoimmune disease, so-called, and that is because of the adjuvants they put in the vaccine. So it turns out that they were able to demonstrate that it's the adjuvants that caused the problem, not the so-called virus. Now, how do I know that? Because that one, and I actually suspect that somebody, I think it was Merck, again, don't quote me on that, but I think it was Merck that did this because they were the company that makes these vaccine. I think somebody went rogue at Merck and did a few hundred girls who actually got a saline control, which, as far as I knew, was the first time that's ever happened. And that's what he's talking about here. I don't remember, but that they had already received three doses of the other one. I don't remember that, but I'm sure he's probably correct. And the result of that was zero of them got diagnosed with an autoimmune disease in the next 6 to 12 months. So that those three things, the actual vaccine conversion rate, 2.5%, the excipients, everything but the quote virus, the conversion rate, 2.5%. Nothing but saline, 0%. That tells you that it's the excipient that's the main source of the damage. And that should have been the end of that so-called vaccine, but it wasn't. And so I just want to finish by saying, I mean, this is great stuff to unearth these facts, so that if you're ever in a conversation with somebody who gives you the old placebo, 661 vaccine trials, it's pure nonsense. So that's great. But I also think, as I've said before, whether it's Aaron Seary or anybody who goes into this fight believing there's these childhood diseases, measles, HPV causes cervical cancer, etc., they will get their hat handed to them, and they're only going to really win this argument, and it's an easy argument to win, as I went over last time, showing that there's no such thing as measles, and nobody has ever been able to define it clinically, and nobody has been able to find the virus. And so that should be the end of it. And until they go down that road, they're going to be stuck fighting this battle forever. And I think it's time to switch tactics, continue to point out these things, but actually get into the real science of this. Whether that happens or not, I don't know. And I'm happy to talk to him. If anybody knows him and can say that I'd like to talk to him, I'd be happy to do it. But I'm not going to hold my breath. Okay. I think that's the only thing I wanted to say before this. So today we're doing chapter four, and the title of chapter four is called Water. And again, I'm going to read this in the entirety without making any comments, and then I'm going to switch over to the YouTube, and if there's a in the chat marked question, I'll take a look at that and see if I can address some of the comments and questions. Okay, chapter four, water. The new biology approach to medicine is based in reality. This means rather than basing our diagnosis and treatment on invisible, often disproven entities like viruses, ribosomes, genes, and much more, we anchor our thinking in what has been observed and proven to be the foundation of life. This means new biology medicine starts with, ends with, and focuses on water. Most of us have heard the statements that at least 70% of a human being by volume is water, and that over 99% of the quote molecules in our body are water molecules. Leaving aside for a moment the hypothetical nature of all molecules, this seemingly observable facts point us to the obvious importance of water for us and, in fact, all things we say are alive. These facts, unfortunately, though, do not capture the true reason why life and water are inseparable, and in many ways, this failure to see beyond volume and molecules is the intellectual downfall of medicine, post-catastrophe biology, or of intellectual downfall of modern post-catastrophe biology and medicine. That is, the connection between water, life, health, and disease is entirely based on water's unique ability to form itself into a fourth phase, a phase with entirely different properties than those possessed by ice, water, or steam. Fourth phase, easy, coherent, structured, or even charged water, are essentially synonyms for the type of water that is the foundation for all of life. The way I imagine this is that the fourth phase water forms itself into a kind of crystalline gel using the various proteins, fats, and minerals to form an infinite variety of these crystals. Each species, cat, human, daffodil, Each has its own signature overarching crystalline structure. Using specific proteins, fats, and minerals, all cats, all giraffes, all humans create this form and structure that allows us to say, yes, this is a cat. This unique crystalline form is what defines it as a species. Then, within the category cat, human, giraffe, there is an individualized variation of this common form. In other words, pumpkin has a slightly different overall crystalline form than does his son PJ. Animal and plants have fairly similar individual forms. Humans have a greater variety in these individual forms. We can define health as the state in which the individual organism, cat or human, is faithful to both the common crystalline form and their individual variation on this form. Again, in other words, you are both a cat and specifically the cat called Pumpkin. You are both a human being and uniquely Tom or Sally. You share a common path and destiny with all humanity, and at the same time, you have your unique history, story, and destiny shared by none other. Interestingly, for many who have thought deeply on these matters, this is almost a felt experience. We have the feeling that something is wrong when we sense that for whatever reason, our ability to express our genuine humanity or our individual destiny is being thwarted. Beethoven or Bach likely could have hardly lived if they had been forbidden to write music. Even Tiger Woods or Michael Jordan would be unrecognizable without golf or basketball. New biology concepts hypothesize that the locus of this individual destiny is a reflection somehow of the crystalline nature of our water. Going deeper into living organisms, we find that we are divided into various parts called tissues or organs. Each of these tissues or organs is also its own kind of unique crystalline form. The liver uses specific proteins, fats, and minerals to form the scaffolding of the crystalline water structure we call a liver. The heart, spleen, brain, etc., use different proteins, fats, and minerals, and in specific ratios to form the perfect or healthy form of each of these various tissues and organs. Crystalline water is electrically charged water. This means that each organ creates an electromagnetic charge or field which flows within it and through it. This is the field or flow which is evaluated in Chinese medicine and which is manipulated by stimulation with acupuncture needles. Again, another definition of health is the condition of which each organ has formed the perfect crystalline structure unique to that organ, and the flow within and through that organ is free and robust. If the structure is distorted and the flow is either stagnant or excessive, this is what we call disease. Finally, there is a saying in medicine and engineering that structure begets function. What this means in biology and medicine is that an organ, say a liver, that has the proper proteins, fats, and minerals, along with a liberal supply of clean, structured, charged water, will be able to create a healthy, perfectly formed liver. This perfectly formed liver will then be able to carry out all the functions that belong to the liver. When this is the case with all the individual organs, and the individual form or blueprint is faithfully adhered to, the organism finds itself in robust health, willing and ready to meet its unique destiny. And again, when this form has been distorted, the sense is, quote, something is wrong. This is what we call disease. The next step is a key component of understanding the principles of new biology and of life. When the situation arises, as it inevitably must, that one or more of the organs, or even the form as a whole, has been distorted, the profound intelligence of the body kicks in to attempt to restore the proper form. The distorted crystalline structure in the bronchial tubes are heated, fever, melted, mucus, and expelled, cough, so a new, more perfect crystalline form can be created. The crystalline form in your knee joint has become hardened, resulting in pain and a loss of function of the knee. Your amazing body again heats up the knee joint, dissolving the hardened, distorted structure. This is a kind of remodeling akin to the demolition phase when you want to remodel your kitchen. Once the demolition phase is complete, a new, more perfect crystalline structure of your knee can be formed. All symptoms, all so-called disease processes, can be understood from this perspective. That's all there is, crystals with energy flowing in them and through them, all arranged together to form the unique manifestation of life we call you. In the next chapter, we look at the various ways our crystalline gels become distorted, blocked, or stagnant. Okay. Just going to shut the door here for a minute. And I'm going to minimize this and this. And then we get to YouTube. And let me go up to the top here. So somebody wrote a whole bunch of questions. So these have all been answered before. Has to do with cold sores. Is that herpes? Warts? Is that a virus? What causes plantar warts? What causes rabies? And then why somebody died of COVID. So there is a, so, you know, one of the things I'm trying to do here. Let me just make sure everybody can hear me okay. I think so. One of the things I'm trying to do here is go over how to talk to other people about these very difficult subjects. Now, it's obviously the case that you're probably not going to want to talk to everybody about it. There's some people that's, as my high school baseball coach used to say, let sleeping dogs lie. And you might just want to skip this because it's not going to go well. But when you're with somebody who's willing to listen, and you're willing to have a rational conversation, to me, the best strategy is to, because we're are the way of science, and I would say the way of knowledge, and the way that I'm trying to follow and also explain is based on this idea that you don't have to know the truth. You don't have to have a replacement theory. You just have to examine the way of science is finding the claim and investigating whether the claim can be falsified. If the claim cannot be falsified, it's a belief system. And if it can, and you can find, you then look for the observation that will verify or falsify the claim. So when you say, so what causes sexually transmitted diseases? You could say syphilis, we've talked about gonorrhea, chlamydia. So it's very simple. The way to do this, it's the same with measles, it's the same with rabies, it's the same with plantar warts, it's the same with any warts. You first, by questioning the specificity of this disease. In other words, how do you know that somebody has syphilis as opposed to herpes, as opposed to gonorrhea, as opposed to just friction, irritation, or a whole lot of other things? And we've been over this with measles, and the bottom line is, almost every one of these, if you go back into the history of medicine, this certainly was the case for syphilis and gonorrhea and sexually transmitted diseases. Nobody was able to definitively say this appearance, this symptom, this sign, in other words, physical exam sign, defines what we mean by syphilis. So before there was molecular diagnostic tests for so-called viral illnesses, nobody could definitively say which one of these so-called syndromes it was, because we didn't have any way of doing that. And every time we tried to make a specific diagnosis and actually study it scientifically, we found that even experienced doctors would not agree on which one was syphilis and which one was gonorrhea, et cetera. Now, I would admit that there are extremes that sort of define the category, but most of the people, like well over 90%, don't fall in those extremes, and there's no way clinically to just tell which one has which one. Therefore, the diagnosis of syphilis as non-specific symptoms and the finding of this spirochete bacteria in the vaginal or secretion, sexual secretions of somebody with this lesion. That's how we diagnose syphilis, or then we say there's an antibody in the blood against this syphilis bacteria. And that's how we know that it's syphilis as opposed to chlamydia or gonorrhea, et cetera. So, in other words, the diagnosis is tied to the claim that we therefore have proven that the bacteria, or in the case of herpes, a virus, has been proven to be the cause of these symptoms. So that's the next claim. Without that claim, you can't you there will be no specific symptoms which you can hang your hat on. Same with measles, same with chickenpox, same with rabies, etc. Nobody can tell you what a case of rabies is as opposed to a whole lot of other non-specific symptoms. So you say, okay, in order to prove that the syphilis spirochete causes disease, it's very simple. Isolate, in other words, have only the spirochete bacteria, expose that to somebody who's sick in the usual way, like put the culture in their vagina or apply it to their penis and see if they get the disease. And then you do a control, so everything else that could be in that vial is also put into the vagina or on the penis. And so the independent variable is the spirochete or the virus. And that study has never been done. And every time they try to do anything close to that, they get no effect from that microorganism. The viruses they obviously can't do because they can't purify and isolate a virus, so they can't even use it as an independent variable. They cannot do a control because they don't have the thing they're trying to find. So at the end of the day, the first thing you can say is there is no scientific evidence that A, there's a specific disease, and B, that it's caused by any microorganism. If you disagree with that, I don't want to hear about what happened to your uncle or you or anybody else. I want to see a study that demonstrates the isolation of that organism and that it causes disease. And I guarantee you will never be presented with that study because it doesn't exist, because the whole thing doesn't work like that. Period. Now, once you're done with that, you could say, well, these are non-specific symptoms. They may not have, they, since they're not a specific disease, they obviously don't have only a single cause. And therefore, every story, and this is the fundamental principle of new biology thinking in medicine, has to do with the story of that person. So, with so-called syphilis, in other words, you have painful lesions in your genitals, sometimes it was because of being treated with mercury or other toxic antibiotics. Sometimes it was an emotional conflict where you didn't actually think it was a good idea for you to have sex with that person. Sometimes it could be a collagen deficiency, so the tissues in your genital organs are weak. Sometimes it could be just excessive friction or sort of a mechanical injury. Other times it could be something else, too acidic an environment. And so you cannot make any blanket statements because there is no unified specific disease that could possibly have a specific cause. Now, that's what we're doing here in new biology is finding out what happened to you. And we know there's certain things like mercury poisoning. If you poison somebody with mercury, it seems to be concentrated in the vaginal and genital secretions. And so that could cause lesions. And then you expose somebody else to it. And that could seeming be like transmission of a microbe when it's really common exposure to mercury. And so that should be the domain of medicine, of the doctor, to help you investigate what happened. And in basically every time, it is something that's not from nature, that is something that shouldn't be in your body, or is a conflict, or you're wearing always underwear that's made out of plastic. You know, there's so many things. And if you get caught into saying, so what is the treatment for cold sores or warts or, you know, herpes or rabies or whatever, you're already caught in a trap of which you cannot win. So do it very systematically. Go first for the specificity of the disease, then the claim in conventional science and medicine, what causes it. Prove that those have never been demonstrated. At that point, you don't know what the problem is, but you don't have to know who your real parents are to know you were adopted. Just always keep that in mind, and that will help you out in all of these kind of conversations. So I'm going to try to go to somebody else here. Got in a lot of questions there all at once, but or maybe these were questions from a whole bunch of people. But I think I already answered that. We talk about rabies, and I do have my rabies fact sheet, which I whip out every once in a while, because this is the one that many doctors, many so-called scientists, that's like their trump card is what about rabies? So I always keep my rabies fact sheet in my drawer here. So I'll read this once again just so everybody has it. So, first of all, from the CDC website, between 1980 and 1996, there were 32 patients in the United States who got what they called rabies. Seven of them had an animal exposure, that's 22%. 25 of them, that's 78%, had no recollection of any animal exposure whatsoever. From 1996 to the present, in the US, according to the CDC, there was 37 cases of rabies in people. 30 of them were acquired in the United States. 28 of them had no recollection at all of any animal exposure. Now, this is not just an animal bite, this is any animal exposure. They were never around any animals at all, which doesn't make you very confident that rabies is from getting bitten by an animal. One thing you do notice is that so-called hydrophobia, or the fear of water, is one of the supposed hallmarks of rabies. But it turns out that animals that drink bitter and toxic water, water that has arsenic in it, mercury in it, insecticides in it, will obviously get irritation of their throat. And this actually drives them a bit crazy as their throat closes. And then they salivate, and you think they have rabies when in fact they have the exposure to toxic water. In the historical accounts in the 1990s, there was a Philadelphia dog pound where they had 6,000 vagrant dogs annually went through there, and thousands of bites. In the 25-year recorded history in this place, Philadelphia dog pound, they had over 150,000 dogs, thousands and thousands of bites, and zero cases of rabies. In the 1900s, in the London hospital, they have 2,666 people were recorded to be have been bitten by the dogs that have been through this hospital. Zero deaths. Zero treatment, zero cases of rabies. In the 1900s at St. George Hospital in London, they recorded over 4,000 dog bites of people admitted to their hospital, zero cases of rabies. And here's another one. Often you will have things like I talked about with the Koplik spots, you'll be told, Koplik spots are specific for measles. And then you find out that the only study they ever did to allegedly look at which virus is found in people who have Koplik spots, and I think the number was 22.5% had the measles virus, 17% had the German measles virus, and the others had all different kinds of viruses. And what that proves is that Koplik spots, according to their own way of categorizing them based on which virus is causing the problem, in this case, the measles virus, turns out not to be specific to the measles virus at all. And since that's the definition of measles, they can't possibly be the defining or pathognomonic signature of measles. And so, similarly, we're told, at least in medical school, that if you find these negri bodies, which are black spots or black lesions in the brain of an animal, that this is the pathognomonic, which means the unique signature of an animal with rabies, or to say it another way, that's the only time you see rabies, negri bodies is with the animal has rabies. But it turns out in controlled studies, the conclusion, and I don't have the study here. They quote say sh they show no evidence of negri bodies being associated with rabies. So it turns out negri bodies are another nonspecific lesion in the brain that happens for a variety of reasons, Probably almost all of them are some toxic insult, which somehow affects the brain. And you see these black lesions in the brain. Doesn't have anything to do with rabies. And the final thing is there's a Pasteur Institute, and it turns out they've had 3,000 cases of death by rabies, and every single one of them followed the treatment at the hospital for the rabies. So, in other words, we have thousands and thousands of cases of dog bites with no rabies, no treatment, and 3,000 cases where people died of rabies, and every single one of them was treated. So, hopefully, that can tell you that there's something very wrong with this story. And something that you would really want to think about before you would get any treatment for rabies. Okay, if someone is doing chemo, is coconut water a good supportive drink? And if yes, why? I don't really know. I like coconut water. I think it's very interesting that a plant makes water inside it. And my guess is, although I don't know if anybody's actually studied this, that it would be very highly structured, mineralized, coherent, charged water. The only thing I would say is also, if any of you have had a chance to drink actual fresh coconut water right out of the coconut that was just picked from a tree, that's a very different experience than the coconut water that is pasteurized and sold in most places in bottles or cans. And so I'm not sure that that coconut water would do you much good, but I think that the coconut water right out of the coconut is it would be similar to seawater in that it's structured by the fact that it's part of a living being. It's got a lot of minerals in it. It's probably got a lot of easily absorbable sugars. It tastes really good. And so my guess is that's the kind of water that we want to be drinking, structured, coherent, mineralized. Non-toxic because it's protected by the plant. So, a coconut that's growing in a very protected, organic, sort of wild place, that probably would be a great thing. I'm not sure specifically doing chemo, and you have to wonder why somebody's doing chemo in the first place. But in general, I think coconut water is a good source of liquid. It's a good way to drink fluid. I do that sometimes, although I wonder about the source, and it's hard to get the best quality source. I would certainly use an organic form or not drink it at all. Okay, let me see if there's any more questions. I don't see any here. Here's this. Here's a question. I get this a lot. What education training do you recommend for an aspiring doctor who wants to practice medicine, teach health, like new biology clinic, not cut, burn, and poison, PhD, DO, master's, otherwise? I don't have an answer for this. I certainly don't advise people to go to medical school, and I don't think DO school is much better, although you do learn some useful skills in if you become an osteopath, whereas you don't learn many useful skills except some sort of surgical procedures if you become a medical doctor. And I don't see the naturopath schools these days being much better. I'm not sure even the chiropractic schools are true to their origin. I don't know any master's programs. And so it's sort of like we're on our own. And I don't really know how to advise people on that question. So I'm going to leave it at that. Somebody asked about Meniere's disease, which is Meniere's disease is generally thought of, and again, these are not specific diseases. These are descriptions of symptoms of varying intensity. So we're talking about somebody with ringing in their ear and dizziness. And the way I see this is we think of it as a dysfunction of the acoustic nerve. And dating myself here, I can't remember which nerve the cranial nerve, the acoustic nerve is. I think it's eight, but I'm probably wrong about that. And so the acoustic nerve is not healthy, and so you end up with problems related to the acoustic nerve function, which are ringing in the ears and dizziness. And so why does this happen? Again, a lot of these things are easy to sort out and understand if you stick to the chapter that I did today. So what is a nerve? A nerve is a, just like everything, is a specific crystalline structure of water. So in this case, it's a tube of structured water in a fatty coating, similar to the wires that run in your house. So you have the copper wire, that's the crystalline nature of water in the tube, and then it has an insulation, which is the rubber surrounding the copper wire. So in Meniere's, it's the impulse along the wire, in meaning the crystalline water tube does not flow properly. It's either stagnant or excessive, or it leaks out the insulation. Now, in copper wires, the insulation is a layer of rubber, and in nerves, it's a myelin or fatty coating. So it's in some ways very similar. So there's basically three possible problems here. One is the myelin coat, the rubber insulation, has been compromised. And so you can imagine if you nick or cut with a knife the insulation on a wire, the electricity leaks out and sparks and causes all sorts of problems with the transmission of that electricity. And so the same thing happens here. And so you get problems with the transmission, and which means the nerve isn't functioning right, which means the nerve is giving out signals that it shouldn't, which means you hear ringing in your ears. And because the nerve has to do with the perception of balance, that's also a function seemingly of the ear, then you also are dizzy. Another problem could be that the crystalline nature of the water that is the nerve proper is not formed properly. Therefore, the electrical signal doesn't transmit well. So it's either slow or stagnant or excessive. And again, that will lead you to send out abnormal signals and misperceive things, which means dizziness and ringing in the ears. And it could be that the formation of the crystalline water tube, has a number of possible reasons why this is not formed properly. But the main reason I think one should look at with this is the electromagnetic influence on the person, because that seems to be a big part of this history and story of anybody with any neurological disease, including Meniere's. And there's another question about ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. Same thing. We have bad nerves. Why do you have bad nerves? Because the crystalline water structure of the nerve hasn't been formed properly. and or the insulation isn't formed. The insulation is a fatty coating, which has at least something to do with the character and the quality of fats you're eating. And then how does a crystalline water form in a nerve? And that has to do with, like I said, in the chapter today, the proteins, the fats, the minerals, and then there has to be an ambient or outsized energy source, which basically means the sun or ultraviolet radiation, which then comes into your body, especially if you're grounded to the earth, and that essentially charges up your water and charges up your tube and makes that water in your tube more coherent and more crystalline, which allows it to function the way it should. And if you've never been out in the sun and you're mineral deficient, and you've never connected to the earth, and you're on computers and screens and in an EMF Wi-Fi toxic home, then you're going to eventually have neurological compromise potentially, which can go to all these different manifestations. The other one is we also are, many of us, exposed to various neurotoxins, especially now we're talking about things like aluminum and other metals, but in particular, pesticides and herbicides. So these, like with the polio story, these interfere with the ability of your body to form the healthy structure and form that is a nerve. And without the healthy structure and form, the impulses don't get carried properly. And so you get either stagnation or excessive impulses, which is interpreted by the body as a ringing in the ear, or decreased hearing, or dementia, or tremor, or paralysis, or any of the other symptoms that we ascribe to healthy functioning of the nerve. So these are not j specific diseases. These are just different manifestations of what can happen when the system, the structure called a nerve, which is a crystalline water tube surrounded by an insulator, just like we make copper wires surrounded by a rubber coating. And if you cut the coating or you don't got the copper wires formed properly, you don't get electricity flowing properly, and then your radio or whatever device you're plugging in sparks and doesn't function properly. And it's all actually very simple. And so all you have to do is go back to the basics question: how do you structure the water? Good fats, good minerals, lots, right kind of protein, and then realize that the water is like a battery and it's oriented between the sun and the earth. I think I just answered what are the most important things to do the gel layer. What about necrotizing fasciitis after getting a cut in the foot? So usually when something like that happens, you know, it's interesting. This also gets into the people who say I stabbed myself in the knee with a metal thing, and because of that, then my knee at some point got red and swollen and painful, and then I took an antibiotic and it went away. So that proves it was a bacterial infection. I've heard that story over and over again, and this is a similar story. Again, you go back to the basics, and in this time, the basic is asking, what did you actually see? So in this case, or with the stabbing in the knee, you say, I saw somebody get stabbed in the knee with a needle or a knife or a sharp object that was metallic. And it was had some stuff on it, maybe dirt, maybe little sparkles, or maybe shards of metal. So that's what you see. And then later I saw pain, inflammation, redness, swelling in that area. And then later I saw that if they gave this particular kind of drug called an antibiotic, it went away. And so that leads you to conclude that it must be the bacteria that caused the problem. But again, you didn't see the bacteria. You can see them, and you can see that there are bacteria there. But then you have to go back to the basics and say, what if I did an experiment, like with an animal, even though I hate to say that, and take a normal joint and inject just the bacteria? They said strep A, so you inject just strep A and anything else that you have to put in that syringe, like a saline. You also put in a control situation. So one animal or one group of animals, the saline plus the strep A, the other is just the saline. So then you're controlling whether it's just sticking a needle in somebody's joint is enough to cause a problem, or sticking saline or anything. And if it's only the strep A and everything else is controlled, that would allow you to say logically, rationally, scientifically that strep A is the culprit, is the cause of that problem. But again, I don't know, and none of us who are working on this know of a single controlled study where that has been found. Therefore, that is a dis or unproven hypothesis at best. And since they've done it over and over again and get nothing, I would almost say it's a disproven hypothesis. So, what could be another possible explanation? Well, there's lots of things that were put into that wound, probably dirt, maybe some toxic stuff in the dirt, maybe glass shards. And so those could have been irritating to the tissue, and that causes some destruction of the tissue. And then whenever there's destruction of the tissue, the body recruits different bacteria and actually pleomorphically converts those into the bacteria that would be the most helpful, in this case, strep. And the idea is to remodel. So we're talking about first you have to do the demolition, which is to eat up the dead and dying tissue, and then you can reform a new tissue that's more perfect after that. Just like you demolish your kitchen, and then you can build a new kitchen. Now, that process of demolition, like with the kitchen, can be painful and cause a mess and hurt, etc. And so you can stop that with antibiotics. And that will stop the remodeling. And so now you have the glass shards and the dead tissue in there, and you've stopped the whole thing. And you also have the toxicity from the antibiotics and probably some dead bacteria. But the symptoms will go away, and then you think you're all better. And then it's often the case that at some point it will recur again, or you'll get similar symptoms again. Unless the body can figure out a different way of remodeling that tissue. So I would just be very careful and cautious with using those observations as proof that it must be a bacteria, because they don't at all lead to that conclusion. Okay, I think we got it. Thanks, everybody, and I hope everybody has a good week, and I will see you next week.